The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Sebastian Junger. Employing what the Washington Post refers to as his narrative gifts and vivid prose to chronicle some of the world's most extreme environments, Sebastian Junger is the number one New York Times bestselling author of The Perfect Storm, War, Fire, Tribe, and A Death in Belmont. A contributing editor to Vanity Fair, and a special correspondent at ABC News, he has earned a Peabody Award and the National Magazine Award. His debut documentary film, Restrepo, which was co-directed with the late Tim Hetherington, won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance and was nominated for an Oscar. His new book is called Freedom. In it, he ruminates on the tenets and contradictions of freedom by way of a year spent with three friends traveling along the East Coast's railroad lines. Tonight, Sebastian will be joined in conversation with Joe Klein, Time political columnist and best-selling author of six books, including Primary Colors, The Natural, and most recently, Politics Lost. Sebastian, Joe, thank you both so much for being here, and take it away.
Okay, well, thank you. Sebastian, congratulations. This is the second time you and I are having a conversation like this, but this one is a little bit weirder, I think. This is a wonderful, but it's also kind of a mysterious book. And I was wondering, what came first, Freedom or The Last Patrol? Or did The Last Patrol give you the idea to write Freedom? And perhaps you can explain what The Last Patrol was.
Yeah, thank you. So The Last Patrol was the name that we gave to a walk that I took with a few friends. We'd all been in combat. A couple of the guys were soldiers. Another guy was a Spanish journalist, photographer. It was a walk that we took along the railroad lines from Washington, D.C. to Philadelphia, heading for New York. But in Philly, we decided to turn west and we headed for Pittsburgh instead. And we did it over the course of a year in several sections. We were completely independent out there, meaning we carried everything that we needed. Every few days, we'd walk through a town and buy some food and go back out onto the lines. It's completely illegal to walk on railroad lines, so we had to avoid the police. At one point, they were looking for us in a helicopter. They couldn't find us. Someone shot at us in Pennsylvania. We had adventures and misadventures, but we were living rough. We were sleeping under bridges and in abandoned buildings. We didn't have a tent. We cooked over fires, kept ourselves warm over fires, got our water out of creeks. And we were all along the railroad line, so we went right through the middle of everything, the ghettos, the rich suburbs, the farms, the wilderness, right through the middle of everything. And we encountered not only America, we encountered ourselves in a pretty intense way. As I say in the book, for about 400 miles every night, we were the only people who knew where we were. And there's many definitions of freedom, but surely that's one of them. We did this walk years ago because we wanted to do it. I had no idea I was going to be writing a book about freedom. But as I started to think about what constitutes freedom and how I would tackle it as a topic, my mind went back to this extraordinary journey that I took. And I thought that's an interesting narrative as an example, one example of a kind of freedom.
Right. So... Why did you decide to do it in the first place? Why railroad lines? And what was your overall purpose in doing it? And how much of it had to do with the experience of that we've both had of being embedded in combat?
There was less intellectual organization around this than you might think. I mean, truly, it was just... I was on the Amtrak going down to DC. I was staring out the window and I just thought, wow, you could walk along this whole damn thing. Like there's dirt bike trails and there's, you know, far cornfields, just maintenance roads, whatever. And because it's a kind of no man's land, I realized I've spent a lot of time outside, you know, at night, you know, sleeping out. And I realized because it's no man's land, there's places to sleep everywhere, like in, you know, thickets and in gullies and, you know, abandoned buildings. And so so I just wanted to experience it. And, you know, I really wasn't thinking about it with an end purpose. It was something I wanted to do. And I also felt like that it would recreate some of the better aspects of combat. I'd been with American soldiers a little bit, but I've been covering war since the early 90s. And there was something about the resourcefulness that's required of one, the presence of mind, just being plugged into the moment that that reminded me of combat. And you know, by example, the train engineers will call you in, right? The guys driving the trains, if they see people on foot, they will call you in, and the cops will come looking for you. And so if you hear a train, if you see a train, you gotta hide, right? So we got very good at sort of jumping into the underbrush or hiding ourselves. But sometimes the trains came so fast, you know, the passenger trains would go 140, that you really didn't have time to get to hide yourself if you heard them. But what we realized is we got so tuned up to that environment, we got so plugged in that we could feel them. And honestly, I don't know what we were feeling. Mm-hmm. We're sensitive to something, and we could pick up on it. We kind of look at each other and be like, oh, it's happening. And something about being tuned up like that made me think of combat in the fondest kind of way.
Well, you know, in the book, and it's really remarkable what you do. I'm going to be raving throughout all this because there are so many great things that you do in this book. But you make the trains and your exploration of the history of railroads, the trains become like almost the enemy. They become this vital force, vital physical force that you couldn't possibly have anticipated. Were you particularly interested in railroads before this started?
No, I had no interest in railroads at all. They're so awe-inspiring. I mean, a freight train, I can't remember now, but it's in my book, but freight train fully loaded weighs 20,000 tons, something like that. I mean, it's a mile long. It's going 60, 70 miles an hour. It takes a mile to stop. And at night, these things go by and it feels like God's coming at you through the woods. I mean, really, right. It's an extraordinary feeling. You feel like you're going to be annihilated. And you don't know what this sound is, and it's coming at you. And even if you're far off the tracks, it's impossible not to be scared. It's really, really quite something. And it inspires a kind of awe. And I became sort of fascinated by them, about the way they worked, just how indomitable they were. There was something about them that I really, really started to like.
Mm-hmm. Well, that reminds me, you know, it's kind of like being mortared in a way, but although less dangerous. But to me, your patrol took on a kind of mythic and really primal American aspect when you turned west from Philly, and you started following the route of the earliest American pioneers. And at that point, did it begin to occur to you then, hey, I'm doing what they did 300 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, particularly as I did research afterwards, you know, I mean, I did this walk some years ago, and I did my research last year, preparation for the book. And then I suddenly realized, oh, west of Harrisburg, all of a sudden things felt different. Mm-hmm. And the reason, there's a sort of geological reason, there's something along the east coast of America called the Fall Line. And it's the first set of waterfalls or shallows in these rivers that penetrate the interior. And you could use deep water, deep draft ships up to the Fall Line. And after the Fall Line, everything has to proceed on foot, you know, by horse or by wagon. Mm-hmm. And so the Fall Line for the Susquehanna happens at Harrisburg. And above Harrisburg is the Fall Line. And after that, the settlers well, the land became much more wild because everything was slowed down. And that's where the early settlers went into what they called Indian territory. And even now, hundreds of years later, the change was amazing. Like all of a sudden, we didn't have to hide from people. It was quite wild. We could sort of sleep wherever we wanted. There was a lot of gunfire. There were, we crossed a sign that said, this is private property. Federal agents keep out. We will defend this property by any means necessary. I mean, it was a very wild and autonomous seeming region. And, you know, we were along the Juniata River. And so the way this works, you know, we were along the railroad lines. The railroad lines were laid along the old settlers' roads. The settlers' roads followed the old Indian trails. The Indian trails followed the sort of route of easiest passage through the mountains. And the only east-west trending river in Pennsylvania is the Juniata. And it cuts through the Allegheny Mountains going towards Pittsburgh. So we were following this ancient travel corridor that goes back thousands of years. And, you know, once we got out there, you know, living was easy. Like we our tasks were not so much dodging the police as keeping warm, keeping safe. It was a very, very different feeling. And it felt very, very liberated. Like I was sort of beside myself. I felt so happy out there.
Yeah, there was a moment in the book where I think your dog was sleeping on your legs, and it was your dog, right? We must establish that the dog was part of this all the way. But there's a point where you said, life, you know, things can't get much better than this. And it seemed to me that in that moment, you were touching on something deeply and profoundly American, a sensibility that affects this country to this day, perhaps even more nowadays than it did 20 years ago. But the notion of moving west, moving into areas where there's no controlling legal authority, to quote Al Gore a long time ago, is the most profound American action, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was out there, the passage you're referring to, you know, we were along the Juniata, east of Lewiston. Mm-hmm. We've been out there for quite a while. We were filthy. We were exhausted. We had gotten some steak, and we found something called a tie plate, which is a very heavy, you know, 20, 30 pound piece of iron, that is nailed down to the spike down to the cross ties. And the steel track sits on the tie plate. So we put a tie plate on some couple of rocks and built a fire underneath it and created a griddle and cooked up this steak. And so there I was, you know, I was falling asleep with my buddies next to me, and we had one weapon, which was a machete. And that was always somewhere sort of central in case we needed it. And one time I had to grab it. And my dog was over my ankles, and we were the only people who knew where we were. Our stomachs were full. Mm-hmm. We were masters of our own destiny. And it was it was totally intoxicating feeling. What mm-hmm. I would say about the settlers, and obviously about us as well, the settlers in the 1700s took on the incredible hardships and risks of the wilderness, of what was called Indian territory, because they were looking for free land. They were looking for an economic opportunity. They didn't want to be controlled by the government. They didn't want to be controlled by the church. This was a free place for them, right? As it was for the native people. But it was also a place of tremendous danger. So the more free they were out there, the more danger they were in. It was a very bloody time, a lot of conflicts with the natives. And because it was so dangerous, everyone, all the settlers, had to be in a kind of mutual defense pact where if there was an Indian attack, they all gathered at the stockade and fought for their lives. And if you weren't willing to do that, you were not part of the community. You were cast out. And you had no social currency. You couldn't get married. You couldn't get a loan. You couldn't get a handshake. You were out of there. And so what people were doing was achieving one kind of autonomy, but there was so much danger associated with that that they had to sign on to a completely new, different kind of obligation, which was to their community for mutual defense. And if you were an adult male and you weren't willing to carry a rifle and a scalping knife and a tomahawk at all times and be ready to fight at a moment's notice. If you weren't willing to do that, well, you were not part of the community and out.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me. A lot of this reminds me of a wonderful book by David Hackett Fisher called Albion's Seed, where he talks about the various English migrations to our shores. And the one that's most interesting to me and that has a really distinctive part of what it means to be American is a group that you call the notorious Scots-Irish. Now, why do you call them notorious? And what part of our American spirit do you think they contributed? Because that's where you really start cutting close to the bone, to where we are right now as a people.
Yeah, so there were a lot of very brave and very desperate, or both, groups of people that were willing to undergo the hardships and the dangers of the frontier in Pennsylvania, the Dutch, the Germans, the English. The Scotch-Irish were sort of a different breed. They were really, they were renowned, notorious for their willingness to fight. I mean, for their sort of pugilism, and be it in a tavern or, you know, on the frontier. And so, you know, there was actually, I found one account where they were given a sort of reprieve from having to pay local land fees if they were willing to settle at the sort of, in the sort of, free fire zone between civilization and the natives. And if they were willing to sort of inhabit that gray zone and insulate the more settled areas from Indian attack, they could do so without paying land fees. And of course, many of them went for it. Now today, you know, the Scotch-Irish were the dominant settlers in the American South. And today they form a disproportionate portion of the US military. I mean, there is a very strong martial tradition in that culture, and it persists today in the form of of enlistment in the US military. It's really interesting. And they got, you know, the guys that I was, you know, when I was embedded with US forces in Afghanistan, there were a lot of there were a lot of guys with Scotch-Irish names. It was almost completely white. The platoon was almost completely white and Latino. And a lot of the white guys were Scotch-Irish. It was really interesting.
Yes, no, that's true. My favorite little factoid about the Scots-Irish was that the tradition of carrying the bride over the threshold came from the Scots-Irish tradition, which was abducting the bride from the other family's house. And that gradually became socialized. But here's where we get into an interesting conflict about America and about the very notion of freedom. Because these folks, and I see the Scots-Irish migration is down through the Appalachians, you know, through West Virginia, through Tennessee, down to Alabama and Mississippi, as you were saying, Kentucky. And there is a tremendous desire there for freedom. And the Scots-Irish were among the most opposed to the, you know, to the Constitution of the United States because it limited their freedom. And yet they had to deal with what you really, I think, brilliantly come up to in this book, which is that you can't have that freedom unless you're part of a community.
Yeah, I mean, I think that sort of like, for lack of a better word, conservative ethos about this is freedom is construed as a lack of government control and oversight. You're free from government scrutiny, from government control. Of course, if there's no government at all, it's a kind of anarchy. And anarchy is a form of social organization. It doesn't mean what people often think it means. It doesn't mean chaos. It means that people are locally governed within the immediate communities. That's what anarchy really refers to. And frankly, I think there's a lot of deeply conservative people, and maybe many of them are Scots-Irish, I don't know, who feel that they would love that. Certainly in where we passed through along the Juniata River, I think a lot of people had me put the question to them, would you prefer to have a government that doesn't extend more than 10 miles out from where you live, and that's the only government you deal with? I think a lot of people would have been thrilled. The truth is, we live in a modern, highly technological, industrial mass society where the things that people need, even along the Juniata River, you know, gasoline, surgery, eyeglass lenses, truck tires, whatever, those things come from a massive and very complex supply chain that needs government oversight, government regulation, and all that. I mean, it's just sort of a fantasy that we can all sort of live in our homestead. Those days are over. But certainly the cultural ideal hasn't left us, and it's enormously appealing. And there's endless movies about that kind of autonomy. And I find it appealing myself. I've been in countries where there was no overarching government rule of law, and it's a kind of hell, actually.
Yes. Well, yeah, I think we both experienced. But so what is freedom in the end? At one point you describe it as a mirage, and then famously, freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose, which you also describe in the pages in the section called Fight, where freedom was, defending yourself was the only choice you had, and it was the ultimate form of freedom.
Yeah, so my book is divided into three sections, run, fight, and think. Mm-hmm. Running is the most reflexive, the easiest way to maintain one's autonomy. And by run, I mean just being in a very mobile society that stays out of reach of, the empire, whatever that may be. Mobile societies, nomadic societies have very high traditions of freedom and actually look down on their wealthy, sedentary neighbors, the sort of valley dwellers that accumulate money, accumulate grain, and are sort of tied to the land and subject to the abuse of a tyrannical leader. I mean, nomads typically look down on those kinds of people. There's a mobile people called the Yarmouk in northern Iran who had this amazing and chilling saying. They were nomads and they lived side by side with farmers, and they had a saying: I do not have a mill with willow trees. In other words, I'm not a farmer. I do not have a mill with willow trees. I have a horse and quirt, like a whip. I have a horse and quirt. I will kill you and go. The enormous arrogance of the mobile free people to the sort of wealthy sedentary people. But the net, if you can't outrun
another example that you deal with, and it's really striking, is the difference between the Apaches and the Pueblo Indians.
Yeah, I mean, there are another great example where you have these two different kinds of societies in the American Southwest. You have the Pueblo people who are much wealthier because they're agriculturalists. They have irrigation. They plant fields. They live in these sort of hilltop towns that are like little fortresses, pretty much impregnable until the Spaniards got there. And the Spanish rolled in the late 1500s, the Spanish rolled them up immediately. The Apache, meanwhile, are materially poor, but completely mobile. Like they were expected, the Apache warriors were expected to be able to move 70 miles a day on foot, right? They could outrun US cavalry in rough terrain or in hot weather. And to be able to do
just
that
day after. How many miles a day could you do on foot on your best days?
Well, we were more heavily loaded than the Apache. I mean, we did 40 and 40, right? We were carrying 60, 70 pounds. And our best day was 40 miles and 40 hours, and that broke us. But, the Apache traveled light, right? I mean, a hunting bow, maybe a gun, moccasins, a little bit of dried meat, whatever. They could basically, like the Taliban in Afghanistan, they could basically jog all day long. Mm-hmm. So the record for the 1,000-mile run is 10 days. In other words, 100 miles a day. Right. That's the human record for a 1,000-mile run. So we're meant to move. Right. We're built to move. But if you can't outrun your oppressor, you're going to have to outfight him. Humans are the only mammal where a smaller individual or a smaller group like the Taliban can outfight a more powerful group or individual. The Montenegrins, this fierce mountain tribe, fought the Ottoman Empire when they invaded Montenegro to make them a vassal state, fought them to a standstill three times. And, you know, in one case, they were outnumbered 12-1, and they killed a third of the Ottoman force and sent the rest packing. But then finally, if you need to maintain your autonomy, your rights within a society, like the labor movement 100 years ago in this country, they weren't trying to overthrow the U.S. government. They certainly weren't trying to outrun it. They were trying to change things. And then you have to outthink your opponent. And that's where this sort of more complex chess game of societal change comes into play in a democracy. One of the keys to that is using women in these movements. Women are very, very effective for a number of reasons. One being that they are great at lateral networks. Men are not good at lateral networks. They're great at hierarchies. Both are important. But women's lateral networks work sort of like spider webs. They're very hard for authorities to penetrate and disrupt. And the other is that the authorities are just more reluctant to commit mass killings of women in the streets. They'll open fire on men without too much of a problem. They have a harder time doing that opening fire on women. I mean, it happens, but they're more reluctant to. So what the strikers did in Lawrence, Massachusetts in 1912 was they started putting women on the front lines of the strikes. And so the National Guard troops with their fixed bayonets, you know, these boys didn't know what to do. They're facing women their mother's age, right? And they were sort of paralyzed. And one police captain in despair said, you know, one good cop can handle 10 men, but it takes 10 cops to handle one woman. And that changed the balance of power in the streets in the favor of the labor movement.
But let's go back to the notion of freedom. I mean, I think that the people who are listening to us are getting a sense of the heterodoxy, the remarkable heterodoxy of this book, and how you weave all these various kinds of anecdotes and also statistics and the difference between a physiology between men and women and the physiology of walking and running and all of these basic things that eventually emerge into a kind of misty picture of freedom. It seems to me that to you, freedom can't really be defined in a single sentence, can it?
No, there's many definitions of freedom. I mean, some people feel that the real freedom is free from free from desire, from longing, from wanting to own, free from material possessions. Other people feel that having a sort of stockpile of wealth that insulates you against the vagaries of existence is its own freedom. Certainly poverty is a great stress. Muhammad Ali, Mike Tyson said that he was freer when he was poor. When he had nothing, he was freest. I talked to a gentleman who had done almost 30 years in prison for committing a terrible crime. He paid his debt to society. He became educated and enlightened in prison and a remarkable man. And I asked him, I said, is it possible? I felt foolish asking it. I felt almost sort of self-indulgent. But I said, is it possible to be more free in prison than outside of prison? And this is not in the book. This is a side conversation. And he said, oh, of course it is. He said, you can't be an addict in prison. Addiction is one of the greatest losses of freedom that there is. And he said, you can't even be distracted. He said, people out here with their iPhones and all their stuff going on, they're not thinking about anything. Like, you're in prison long enough, eventually you got nothing to do but think. And eventually you're gonna have a conversation with yourself, an honest conversation about who you really are and how you got into this place. And until you do that, like, you're not a free person. And a lot of people on the outside never get around to that. So what I would say is that it's impossible to be completely safe, completely comfortable, and completely free. Your safety comes from being part of a group. Your comfort comes from being part of a group. And as soon as you're part of a group, you owe it things. And if you're alone in nature, like, I mean, completely alone, like they drop you into the Alaskan wilderness, you're not going to be free very long because you're going to be dead. And as soon as you're part of a group, you have to abide by the norms of the group. And that's where the great conversation starts about what about when you belong to a nation of 330 million people? Like, at what point does the government stop having the right to tell you what to do and micromanage your life? And at what point do you owe your country things like, you know, I'm going to stop at red lights and wear, you know, and even at 2 a.m. when there's no traffic, I'm still going to stop at the red light because we all need rules. And I'm also going to wear a mask because I don't want to infect anyone with COVID. You know, I mean, that's the great conversation. There's no right or wrong answer. It's a debate. It's a compromise. It's somewhere in the middle. But that is what a nation like this has to conduct to remain equitable and free and fair.
And you take it to very sophisticated economic kind of levels when you start talking at the very end of the book about, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing this correctly, it's the Gini index, or is it the Gini index?
The Gini index. Yeah, that's right. So Gini was an Italian economist, and basically he figured out how to calculate, how to describe mathematically the income gap within a society. And it ranges from 0 to 1.0. So a low Gini coefficient is a more egalitarian society. Hunter-gatherer societies are famously egalitarian, very little accumulation of wealth, not because they're morally superior. These societies, as soon as they can accumulate wealth, so social stratification will start. But in that environment, they're quite egalitarian. They have a Gini coefficient of 0.25, okay? The Roman Empire was around 0.4. That's roughly where the United States is right now. The medieval Europe was a Gini coefficient of almost 0.8. That was brought back down by the Black Plague that killed a third of Europe. So what liberals will say, I mean, the conservatives typically say freedom means that you're not controlled by the government. Liberals will say, well, the government controls us enough to make sure that everyone's fair and gets a piece of the pie. And that's the great liberal conservative debate. But what's interesting to point out, I'm a liberal, right? I mean, I vote democratically in elections, and I consider myself a liberal. And as a liberal, I've always believed that the smaller the gap between rich and poor, the greater the potential that society has to be a great society, to be a powerful nation. It's more stable. People are happier. And I believe in all those things, except that the truth is that the great empires in history, including America, which is a great empire, the British Empire, the Roman Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Han Dynasty, all of these great empires typically had Gini coefficients of around 0.4, 0.5, like in the sort of middle range of unfairness, not enormously unfair, but pretty unfair. That was offensive to my liberal sensibilities, but I'm a journalist. I report what I find out to be the truth. And there it is in my book, as much as I hate to admit it. But a powerful society often depends on some internal unfairness.
Right. And, you know, one of the things I kind of loved about your last patrol was that you weren't entirely strict about it. Every once in a while, you would go down into town and get a hamburger, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, that was one of the pleasures of it. Like, it's great feeling like an outsider. And when you've been sleeping in your clothes for a week and you walk into town, you know, we would dump our big packs on the sidewalk and tie our dog to them. No one would mess with them, right? And we'd go in and sit down, and you know, people would be a little suspicious, a little curious, a little friendly. You know, we're nice guys, you know, whatever. We made it work, but there was something really cool about walking in one end of town and getting a cheeseburger and keep walking and walking out the other end of town. And then they never saw us again. And there was one, we stopped at one place in, what was it called? Derry, Pennsylvania, Derby. I can't remember.
Derry.
Little town. And there was a little diner joint named Smitty's, a bar. And we sat at the bar stools and ordered sandwiches or whatever. And Smitty came out and sort of sniffed us, you know, literally, I think, and asked what we were about. And he said, you know, well, it was a very hot day. He said, there's some rain coming. There's some relief coming for you guys. You know, I know it's been tough on you. He said, you know, if you need a place to sleep, there's a deserted trailer about a mile west of town, right along the railroad tracks. And there was a guy who was out of a job. His lady kicked him out. And he spent last winter there, but I don't think he's there anymore. If you guys need an old trailer to sleep in, you can find it. And so, you know, off we ate our sandwiches and off we went and found that trailer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have two more questions for you, and then we'll turn this over to the audience. I think it's going to be interesting to see for me to see which one is more awkward for you to answer.
But, I love these. Yes, go ahead.
Let's do the personal one first. What this was happening at a time of your life when you were in a personal crisis, right? Or a time of change. What did you learn about yourself through all this? There was a point where you just couldn't go any farther.
Yeah, so I was in the middle of getting a divorce. There was another guy out of the four of us, so half the group was in the middle of getting a divorce. My divorce was very friendly. I'm still friends with my ex-wife, and she's an amazing person. You know, so it wasn't acrimonious, but it was a very, very sad time in my life. And, you know, it was a failure of something that I really cared about. And so we never talked about it. I mean, we walked 400. Is this a male thing? I don't know. Maybe it was just us four. You know, half of the group was in the middle of getting divorced, and neither of the guys brought it up. And neither of the other guys brought it up either. Like, no one mentioned it. But here's the thing. The journey we took felt good, right? It wasn't that I needed it as a form of therapy. I needed a respite from what was going, the complicated things that were going on in my life. And there's nothing like walking 15 miles a day and dodging the cops and sleeping rough to give you a kind of vacation from your thoughts, right? But after 400 miles, you know, we got to Connellsville and we had this idea of pushing on a little further, and we've been walking through a great summer heat and our feet were just in shreds. And
you described your feet as having the bottom of your feet as having the quality of oatmeal.
Yeah, I mean, you sweat a lot, and then your feet sort of boil in your boots, and they just turn to mush. I mean, it's disgusting. And
sounds wonderful.
We waded in the Youghiogheny River right in the middle of downtown Connellsville. It's a very poor town, and people get out of the heat by wading into this industrial river right in the center of downtown. And we joined them, 100 degrees in the evening, you know, and we joined them, and we had another 15 miles to go. And we were going to sleep on the beach somewhere, I don't know, under a bridge or whatever, and then push on the next day. And I just thought, you know, you need to know when you've arrived at an end point. And that's true for marriage. That's true for drinking. It's true for jobs. It's true for journeys. You got to know an end point when you meet it. And I just suddenly had this feeling like this worked, this helped, and it's time to go back to my life and face my problems. And so that's what we did.
What is that feeling? I mean, you would come to a catharsis, yeah? Of sorts? Yeah,
I just realized that the solution to something can become its own problem. You know, I mean, if you're... you know, that, like the solution for sure can become its own addiction, its own dependency. And I was starting to become dependent on not being dependent on anything, on being free, on being, you know, where no one being sleeping, where no one knew where I was. And that's, you know, that's the thing about, for example, about affluence, is that affluence frees you from a lot of things. It's a very powerful form of freedom. But it also becomes a dependency. You become dependent on affluence, on comfort, and then that's not freedom. And so it, you know, you can go in circles. And I got to the point where I realized my freedom was becoming its own form of confinement and restriction, and I needed to go back and like reassemble my life. I now have two. You know, I'm remarried. I have two little girls. I'm as happy as could be. I'm way happier than I would be sleeping under a bridge, though that has its charms. I have to admit. You know, here I am. I feel like I did it right.
Well, the last question is to ask you to extrapolate this experience and this rumination on freedom nationally. Do you think that it's time for, I mean, it seems to me that an awful lot of the Trump movement was fantasizing about a kind of freedom. what lessons do you think, I mean, it seems very clear from the book that you've caught the zeitgeist of the moment. We're trying to figure out what freedom, which is our essential value in this country, what it means. And so, given what you've been through, what lessons, you know, would you extrapolate to the society?
Yeah, well, you know, what I'd say is that, first of all, we have the right to be free of oppression, not free of obligation. And your platoon, your last patrol group, your outward bound course, and your nation can ask them things of you. It can ask you to fight a war. It can ask you to wear a mask. It can ask you to stop at red lights, even when it's 2 a.m. and no one's going in the other direction, and ask all kinds of things of you. And it's, you know, honestly, there is a forum for debating these things. There's recourse in the courts at the ballot box. But if you start thinking about belonging to this great nation as a high honor, and that the things it asks you to do, you know, considering how fortunate we are, the things it asks us to do are so minimal that I feel like it's an honor. You know, I mean, it's, you know, like, I, you know, I give blood. It's an honor to give blood. I almost died last summer from a ruptured aneurysm that I didn't know about. I lost 90% of my blood into my abdomen, right? They barely saved me. 10 people donated blood and saved my life, right? I started donating blood. It's an honor. It's an honor to vote. It's an honor to serve in a on a jury. It's an honor because there is something sacred. Anything that keeps this nation going and keeps it as a democracy is sacred. And it's an honor to do something like that. So, you know, what I would say is that the word freedom is dragooned into service by people who are trying to make things turn out their way, right? And the left can do it and the right can do it. They both do it. But on January 6th, the people that claimed they were defending their freedom by storming a building and threatening to hang the vice president, that's not freedom, right? That's fascism. You don't, in this country, you don't have the right to make every election turn out in your favor. That's just not a democracy, I'm sorry. What you do have the right to is a free and fair electoral system and a peaceful transfer of power. And if you think there's something funny going on, you can go to the courts, or you can just get out the vote on the next election and turn the tide. That's what you have the right to. And so what we mustn't do is become, is to fall for this trap that as soon as someone says they're fighting for their freedom, that somehow they can't be questioned. It's complete nonsense. That word is sacred and has very specific meanings, and none of them apply to January 6th.
Right. We'll go to questions now. I'm looking at a couple. Here's the first one. This is from Riley Stone, who was very much enjoying our conversation, which he described as brotherhood, which I feel honored by. But not to simply play the contrarian, but if you hadn't had a safe place to return called home, do you think you would have felt as free?
Oh, it's not contrarian. It's an excellent question. No, I mean, there is something very comforting about having a community and a home to go back to. Mobile societies have that. I mean, the whole, you know, the Apache were one huge mobile society that took their home wherever they went. We live in a modern industrial society where in order to feel a certain kind of freedom, you have to leave your home and you have to essentially be what we call high-speed vagrants. I think that being high-speed vagrants for your entire life would be unbelievably hard and would feel like a kind of punishment. Absolutely. I mean, for that matter, almost everything, if you had to do it for your whole life, is a kind of punishment, including great, great wealth.
Mm-hmm. Here's an interesting one from Barbara Elser. Do you think that freedom is defined differently for women than men, given your examples are generally macho?
You know, freedom, the word freedom usually is applied to freedom from attack and by an enemy. I mean, it usually describes a group and if it is free vis-a-vis other groups that would attack it. What I would say about the awful history of slavery in America is that African Americans were tragically not part of this society. They rightfully looked at white America as the enemy because it was enslaving them, right? Now that that wrong, that terrible wrong has been corrected, other great changes have happened with civil rights, with women's rights in the last 100 years. You know, what I would say is that within a society that has democratic norms and recourse through the courts and through the ballot box, that what we're really talking about are rights, and women have the right to not be attacked, right? As do African Americans, as does everybody. And so I think the sexes have different sense of vulnerability. You know, I think had we been four women, we definitely would have felt more vulnerable and probably less autonomous, less free to be to do what we were doing. I think that's probably has been true throughout history. And I'm not sure exactly what we can do about it. The problem with physical security is that it's partly up to your attacker. And that's a hard thing to control for. The Yamnaya were a group of nomadic horsemen from the Eastern Steppe in Russia. And 5,000 years ago, they traveled without women. And they were basically the first motorcycle gang in a sense. They used horse-drawn chariots. They cut a swath through Europe and invaded Iberia, and within about 100 years killed all the men in Iberia, wiped the Iberian males from the human gene pool, and clearly mated with all the women, a gross violation of everybody's freedom. They were able to do that, and the Iberians couldn't stop them. So, you know, part of freedom comes from being able to defend yourself, and I think there's a great tragedy in the fact that women feel that sometimes they're vulnerable in the ways that men aren't. And I don't know what the solution is to that.
But to press the point a little bit, if freedom, one form, the most primal form of freedom for men is to be hunter-gatherers, what is freedom for women? And that's question number one. And question number two is, have we reached a point in this society where male dominance, which was based on physicality, is going to be going to fall into the shadows, given the fact that women are graduating from college at a much greater rate. They are much better at negotiating. They probably will be pretty damn good at governing, and they don't suffer from testosterone poisoning.
Well, I mean, women were hunter-gatherers too. I mean, our hunter-gatherer ancestors were 50-50 men and women. So women are just as much part of that, our human ancestry, obviously, in a hunter-gatherer economy. You know, in modern society, in today's America, yes, obviously women are being increasingly incorporated into all sectors of the economy. You know, what I would say is that the some jobs select for certain character traits, right? And so aggression and competitiveness are great traits to have in the boxing ring, or if you're heading up a corporation, or being a, in some cases, a politician. And so what you see is that there are plenty of women in those roles, but they are women who are aggressive, competitive women, right? So when you say, oh, you know, women are gonna enter the workforce, that have entered the workforce, that doesn't necessarily mean that non-competitive, non-aggressive women are suddenly taking over everything, right? I mean, those jobs select for aggressive, competitive women who are act and have sensibilities and character traits that are very, very similar to what we consider to be male traits. There's probably more men with those traits than women, but there's plenty of women with those traits. You know, I would argue that, I don't know, Sarah Palin was a pretty competitive, aggressive woman. It's why she made an excellent politician. I didn't vote for her, but, you know, she was clearly pretty good at positioning herself for a position of power. So I think it's a mistake to sort of divide things along gender lines and say that women are one way and men are another. I think it's way more complicated than that.
Let's move to an otherworldly aspect of freedom. Question from Moin Rahman. Sebastian, it appears freedom is realized in all its facets when one is non-attached to material and worldly things, including self. It almost sounds more like Epictetus, the Stoic philosopher, or Buddha's point about not fearing impermanence. Your thoughts from the aforesaid vantage points. Is freedom the loss of self?
Well, I mean, we're all barreling towards that. We're all going to die and lose ourselves, ourself, right? So if you can practice for that by being a Stoic, by being a Buddhist, by having a sort of Zen practice of giving up not only your earthly possessions, but your earthly desires and your entire sense of identity and permanence in the world, if you can practice for death by doing that, yes, there's a kind of freedom from the fear of death. What I would say is that if you were freed from all earth, if you were on a life raft in the middle of the ocean and freed from all earthly possessions, you would drown. You would no longer be in the life raft. If you were dropped into the Alaskan wilderness and suddenly there went your Leatherman tool and your box of matches and your tent and et cetera, you wouldn't live very long. So the sort of lofty philosophical enterprise of freeing yourself from your physical animal existence, that's a very particular kind of human game to play, and it's fascinating. But actually, we're animals, we're social primates. We wouldn't be here if that was the ultimate form of freedom, and that we all practiced it. We would have died out.
There's a question here about from Darnell Tomolinsky. I read you talk about Jane Goodall in the book. Can you give us some context? Did you spend time with her?
Unfortunately, I love to spend time with Jane Goodall. I was not able to. I know a student of hers, Richard Wrangham, a primatologist out of Harvard, amazing man. I know him fairly well. So, one degree of separation from Jane. But so what she found was that the, of course, we're closely related to chimpanzees, their nearest mammalian relative. And so there's what Jane Goodall discovered was that there was this sort of difference between how chimpanzees treated, they would attack rival troops of chimpanzees and one by one kill the males, just like the Yamnaya. They would kill the males and mate with the females. And occasionally chimpanzees would kill a member of their own, like they would gang up on a dominant male and kill him. But what they treated the corpses very differently. They did not dismember and eat their own when they killed their own. They treated them with a kind of respect. When they killed the enemy, they would mutilate them, mutilate the testicles. They would eat them. They would treat them like game, like they killed game. And so with the, I talk about that because there's a basic human reality, which is the word freedom comes from the Middle German Vridom, V-R-I-D-O-M. It means beloved. And it basically means freedom is the domain of you and your group and the people you love, your clan, your tribe. And you can essentially do anything you want that you can get away with to everybody else. And two completely different standards of treatment for the in-group and the out-group. And of course, what the international and our national laws have done, and this goes to the question about women, is that it has codified decent ethical behavior that respect human rights by saying even if an individual or a group can't physically defend itself from attack, the law is here to uphold our human dignity, our human freedom. And the law will step in to protect you. Now, of course, that gets very complicated with something like the Black Lives Matter movement, where there's some very clear biases in law enforcement, and that's where a just society has to really be honest with itself about who's getting fair treatment and who isn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're coming down to the end, and I have to say that it has. I'm 74 years old now, although I play younger. But it's been nearly 10 years since I was in a war zone, and I can't imagine myself going back into one now. What point of your life are you in now, and what is your next adventure?
I've got two little girls. That's my adventure. You know, I became parenthood late. I'm 59. My oldest girl is 4. I haven't been in a war zone since 2008. A lot of things changed in my relationship to war. And then I had children. I would defend them with a shovel against anything. You know, and one of the things I would defend them against is something happening to me that would deprive them of a father. And so I mean, forget about going to war zone. I don't even cross the street against the light. You know, I mean, I'm an extremely careful person because I'm not gambling with my life. I'm gambling with their lives in a sense.
Right. Where do you turn from here then? If you're not going to do, I mean, you were so much associated with the notion of physical activity and physical danger. And yet it's so clear from your books that there's an awful lot going on above the neckline, an incredible amount.
I feel like you can have incredible adventures in your mind, with your mind. Whether you're in prison or whether you just decide that the locus of your focus of your attention is at home with your children. There's no reason the whole family can't be mobile. We intend to go to Africa. We intend to raise our children all over the world. God forbid that they think that the only way to lead one's life is in the American style. Mm-hmm. The American style is an amazing country, but it's just one country. And Africa, Asia, South America, it's all beautiful. It's all amazing. I want them to experience that. So I think that's where I'll be getting my quote adventure from.
Yeah. Well, we raised our kids all over the world and I think they benefited from it. And I think that this perspective that you've been able to give, not just from overseas, but especially in this book of the, you know, throbbing heart of America and of the spirit of America is something that I would recommend wholeheartedly, not just to the people who are watching, but to anybody who I come upon and who asks me, what have you been reading that's interesting lately? And I will say, Sebastian Younger's book about freedom. And I guess that does it for us tonight, but it has been a real pleasure to talk to you, and I'll see you on the Cape.
Thank you, Joe. It was a real pleasure to talk to you as well. I loved it.
Okay, great. Thank you, and good night.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.